Good morning, everyone. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. This morning we will hear about the horsemen hidden in the dust. And I wanted to give a little background first, how I came up with this topic, what my interest in this was. And it goes back a long way. When I first joined our Ramakrishna Order, it was 1981, and I joined in a place called Trabuco Canyon, which previous to that was called Trabuco College of Prayer. It was founded in the early 40s, 1942, by a man by the name of Gerald Hurd. And most people don't know his name today, but at that time he was well known. He was a very good speaker. He was part of that same group, you could say, with Christopher Isherwood and Aldous Huxley and some of the others, many of them British, good writers, who came under the sway of Swami Prabhupada, who was the head of the Vedanta Society of Southern California in those days. So he ran this place. It was called Trabuco College of Prayer, but it wasn't a college. It was actually a kind of spiritual community. And it was based on mystical traditions from all different religions. Although the Vedanta was the kind of key to the whole thing, it tied everything together. But they also studied Christian mysticism and Buddhism and Sufi teachings and the whole gamut, all of that. Now, he kept this project going until 1949. And due to the war and other reasons, the lack of interest in the whole thing, anyhow, he gave up the project and donated that property to the Vedanta Society of Southern California. That became the first kind of monastery, you could say, of Southern California. And the first set of monks, there were four of them, they moved there. And nice thing was that he left all of the books there. So when I first joined and saw the library, I was delighted. And I devoured many of the books on different areas that I really hadn't studied too much, some a little bit. But so I went through all the lives of the Catholic saints. I went through a lot of the Buddhist literature. And there was a nice selection of Sufi literature. So I went through all of that, and I was really charmed by a lot of the Sufi literature because of how similar it was to our Vedantic teachings, perhaps more so than what we find in the lives of the saints from other traditions and everything. It was tremendously similar, and the imagery was also very beautiful and a lot of humor to it and everything, so This was something that kind of stayed with me, this love of the Sufi literature and poetry that I read so much of at that time. Now, one of the great poets, and we can say the most outstanding and most famous, and according to some, the most famous mystical poet of all traditions, was Rumi, Jalaluddin Rumi. He was tremendously prolific. He wrote so many different poems and short verses and everything. And I also, and I'll get to this a little later, remember seeing some memorials to him in other places when I traveled through Central Asia, because he was originally from what is present-day Afghanistan and then moved to what's now Western or Eastern Turkey, that area. So I remember seeing his name there and everything. But as I say, some of the teachings that we find are so similar, even something like reincarnation, which we don't associate much with the Sufi tradition or Islam at all. But he has a very beautiful poem, again, one of his more famous poems, and I'll just read it, a short one. He said, "I died as mineral and became a plant. I died as plant and rose to animal. I died as animal and I was man. Why should I fear? When was I less by dying? Yet once more I shall die as man, to soar with angels blessed. But even from angelhood I must pass on. All except God doth perish. When I have sacrificed my angel soul, I shall become what no mind ever conceived. Oh, let me not exist, for non-existence proclaims in organ tones, to him we shall return. Very, very beautiful. We see the mysticism of it, non-existing but becoming one that way. So the individuality melts away and that ultimate union takes place. So Rumi, if you read his poems, you'll see that he spoke about this, really the path of love. This mystical love, the love between the lover and the beloved, from this very high mystical point of view, and with this idea that this union was something that always existed, but some separation came. So we want to reestablish that essential union that we have with God, the beloved, that way. So I appreciated all of his poetry, but there was one line that stood out and stuck with me for all of these years, and that's the line that, of course, gives rise to the title of this talk this morning. In one of his poems, and the rest of the poem is not so remarkable, but this one line is really something. Again, within the heart, there is a heart hidden, like a horseman hidden in dust. The stirring of the dust is caused by the horseman. It is he who causes this dust to dance. Now, what I like about this is two things. One, the imagery of the horseman, and I'll get back to what that means because it has a special meaning in that part of the world, the horseman. But so many similarities to our very traditional Vedantic ideas, teachings of Sri Ramakrishna and Swamiji and Holy Mother about God dwelling within the heart and yet covered by a veil of Maya somehow, hidden from our view somehow by this veil of Maya. And we get a very nice explanation of where that Maya comes from, what that source of Maya is, and then finally, what strength and majesty lie within that divine presence within the heart. The horseman on this strong horse with the dust flying and everything. So we had all these beautiful things come just in this one short line of a short poem. It's only, I think, 4 verses long. Before going on, I want to just say a few words, give a little background on Jalaluddin Rumi, the great Sufi author and saint, we can say. He was born September 30th in 1207. And throughout the world, especially in India, this was the beginning of a real Renaissance period. And all these great devotional teachers came, and mystics and poets, songwriters and everything. So it was even taking place then. He was born in the city of Balkh, which is now in Afghanistan. At that time, there was no Afghanistan. Everything was the Persian Empire, which included parts of Turkey and Afghanistan and Pakistan, even some parts of India. It was a huge area at that time. Later, everything got broken up a little bit, but this town where he lived at that time was a great center of learning. It was one of the old traditional cultural cities of Central Asia. So a major center for Persian culture and Sufi writing. So he wasn't the first Sufi. But he was a scholar. He was a scholastic. He didn't start. He came from a highly educated family, very high cultured family. And his profession was to write scholarly things and to decide questions, legal questions and things like that. So this was the type of life he was leading until one day he met his guru and everything changed for him. So we find that while he was still in his 30s, and as I say, a great theologian, a great scholar, something we can say like Chaitanya Deva before he met Ishwarputi. that he was a great Sanskrit pundit and everything, a little bit proud and everything. Perhaps Rumi was like that at the time. But he met this man named Shams e Tabriza, who was just a wandering holy man, we can say, and a little bit wild and unkempt and uncultured, but a great mystic, someone who had great, deep types of realizations. And he seemed to wander into Rumi's life as if seeking him. It's interesting, we find the very same thing when the Bhairavi Brahmani came, when Totopuri came, as if they were looking for someone, and as soon as they saw Sri Ramakrishna, they recognized he was the one. So it was the same thing here, that he recognized Rumi as potentially a great lover of God. And Rumi also recognized him, so that he accepted him as his teacher, as his guru. Then there's a lot of mystique and all sorts of intrigues that take place. He was much older, but Rumi had arranged a marriage between him and his daughter, and then they say that his other son had him killed or something. In any event, this Shams passed away at one point, and Rumi, if you read all of his poetry, you'll see that part of it was this tremendous longing for oneness with the Guru and with God, both. So that they kind of merge together. And we have many traditions like that in India, Sufi traditions and others. This Guru Bhakti, the Karta Vaja, this worship of God, almost, we can say, in the form of the Guru. So as a result of this, we have nearly 70,000 verses of poetry, mostly in Persian, some in other languages, even Greek. He was, as I say, he was a great scholar. And after his death, his son started what we now know is the most famous Sufi order, where they do the whirling dervishes, where they do that dance. He himself didn't start anything, but his followers did. So because of him, now we have this, what's called Mevlevi order of the whirling dervishes. And their dances are something beautiful. So their spiritual path really is this ecstatic union with God through music and song and dance. A little bit like kirtan, of course, but they do this whirling kind of thing. Has anyone seen it? Yeah, that's really beautiful. Something beautiful to watch. So we see in his poetry these really beautiful mystical flights of oneness between the lover and the beloved. So he falls, as I say, within a long tradition, most of them we know from India, but a long tradition of ecstatic spiritual seekers who somehow express their mystical joy through poetry. Through poetry and writing, some of it very spontaneous. Guru Nanak, Kabir, Mirabai, Surdas, Chaitanya Deva, and later even Ram Prasad, Kamalakanta. And just to name a few, India. There's one of the nicest things about the tradition in India, that it gave rise to so much beautiful poetry, because some of these saints were so talented, such skilled, wonderful writers, at the same time as being these ecstatic mystics that way. And like, just as we see in India, where they had no interest in caste, they had no interest in high or low. It was a very democratic type of movement. Same thing happened with Rumi and that tradition. Even though, as a scholar, he always had to make decisions who was a high caste and low caste, all of that they had. But after his transformation, we can say, then he didn't care for any of these rules of society, for caste, for any distinction between high and low, but only for love of God. So if we want to try to extract some specific teachings from the writings of Rumi and from that particular Sufi tradition, it would be some very simple things. The heart yearns for union with the beloved, which is our real state, and from which we've become separated somehow. And we'll get this Maya idea that comes in. And that the path to union is through ecstatic love and longing. And this love and longing, as we saw, is expressed through this music and dance and poetry. And then he also says that after one establishes attains this blessed state of union, one goes back into the world and works for the welfare of others. So we have a little bit of this idea of the vijnani, that someone who goes back and lives a whole life of service without distinction of belief or race or class or nation or anything like that. He has another nice short poem. He said, "On the seeker's path, wise men and fools are one. In his love, brothers and strangers are one. Go on, drink the wine of the beloved. In that faith, Muslims and non-Muslims are one." Now, some of the other Sufis and everything were persecuted because their ideas were considered a little heretical. But Rumi was beloved, and now the most beloved, really, of all the Sufi poets. Now, I want to go back to the line of the poem which forms the theme this morning, "The Horseman Hidden in the Dust." When we read the Upanishads, we find many verses, many of the different sections of the Upanishads, speaking of two very specific things. One is that Brahman, or that divine presence, sometimes even the personal God, dwells within the hearts of all. Gita, throughout the whole tradition, whether dualist or non-dualist, it doesn't matter. A very common theme that throughout all of Vedanta, that God dwells within the hearts of all. If we think of it as the higher self, according to the non-dualists, that's fine. If we think of it as the antaryamin, the inner controller, the personal God of the devotee, then that also fits in very well. So we have really no concept of God as being outside of ourselves. God may be outside also, but God is found inside, dwelling within the heart. This is why all of our hymns, Hrade Kamala Madhye Rajitam Nirvikalpam, that where do we meditate on Sri Ramakrishna? Where do we worship him? Dwelling within the heart, shining, radiant within the heart. And then Holy Mother, Dhyaye Chitta Sarojastam. So she's also dwelling within that lotus, within the heart. So we have this idea of God is shining. God is fully manifest within the heart. Sometimes seated on a lotus, we have a different images that we have. Sometimes just an empty space the size of a thumb, which really means infinite that way. But we have another view, another way of looking at it, which is a little bit different, and that is hidden in the cave of the heart. Now that we get this idea of hidden more. One is it shining, ever available to us, but hidden. Both are true, just as the sun is always shining, but hidden by the cloud. Both are true, but this represents more of our present situation, where we're not aware of it, or we search for it, we're looking for we long for union with that divine presence, but somehow a little beyond our grasp. So whenever we find this image of the cave, we have this idea of nihidam. We have this daigura, the hidden, not available to us somehow. Either because the cave is very dark, we can't see very well inside a cave, or somehow buried, somehow like treasure that's buried beneath the ground that we have to make some effort to reach, but present, always present. That idea is always there. So this is exactly what we find in these lines of Rumi, with the horseman hidden within the dust which is raised by the horseman himself. Now, why the heart center? This is something that runs through all of the literature. Again, not simply the devotional literature, the Upanishads. We sometimes make this a head and heart distinction, that if it's going to be the path of knowledge and if it's going to be something cerebral, that we think it's within the head. And even Sri Ramakrishna, when he'll talk about Shiva Yoga and Vishnu Yoga, he'll talk about the head and the heart. It's a useful distinction. But really, if we think about it, whether it's an emotion or whether it's a thought or a perception, it's all within the mind. And the ancient tradition always placed the mind in the heart center. In fact, this word manas, which we translate as mind, very often is translated with equal validity as heart. So we have the name Suman, right? What does that mean? To I see, when I first heard that, I thought it meant, well, intelligent. Then I met somebody and he said, oh, my brother's name is Suman. He said it means good-hearted, kind-hearted. Yeah. So even this man, Su, there's not a big distinction that way. It means both. So there's a heart center. There's a heart center is the center of consciousness, the center of awareness. Somehow awareness, we need the mind somehow. So the mind is also considered there. Sometimes the mind is, we say, is all-pervading. And of course, consciousness is transcendent. But this pure consciousness will manifest somewhere. It'll manifest through the mind, within the heart. When we say the size of a thumb, that simply means that there's a very subtle space within that's pure emptiness. It's not cluttered by anything. There's no ego there. There's no thought there. It's pure awareness. So they say the size of a thumb to indicate that it's a very subtle type of thing. So we have these different images. We have the cave, we have the lotus, we have Brahmapuram, we have the city of Brahman, or simply this empty space, the size of a thumb, and yet infinite. Now the second reason why the Upanishads speak of the heart center, not the physical heart, the heart center is kind of the locus for Brahman, is a very nice explanation given by Ramana Maharshi. He said, when we refer to ourselves, we say I. We don't say I, right? So our sense of identification of who we are, I, if we point to the heart, he says to the side of the heart. But in anyhow, generally we point to the heart center. So we have this feeling that our sense of who we are. So both the self-identity and the identity of the absolute are placed here, and this is why we have our soham, where they're really one and the same. Then the other thing also, of course, we know that the heart has the vital organs, the heart center, the cavity, has the heart and the lungs. And these are the two things that are susceptible to emotion. When we get a little bit upset, our breathing will become a little fast, the heart may start pumping a little faster, we'll feel it that way. So this is also for the devotional schools. This is that sense of identification of the heart with emotion is there also. So we have some idea of what we mean by the heart. What is the heart within the heart that Rumi speaks about? Again, this is perfectly Upanishadic. We can say in language, in theory, where we hear about the eye behind the eye, the mind behind the mind, ear behind the ear. That self behind the witnessing self behind the apparent self, the real self behind the apparent self, the silent witness, that pure consciousness, the divine self, the supreme Lord, all together, all in one package. We don't have to say that no, it's simply the Sakshin, it's the witness. Someone say no, this is the personal God. It's all the same. We view it from different points of view. When we're in one mood, we may think of it as my real self. I am that. From another mood, that ego is there, we'll think, yes, God is dwelling within my heart. Even Sri Ramakrishna had different moods. He would say, sometimes I look within, I see that there too, the Divine Mother is there and her child is there. Other times he would say, I see Mother alone exists. Then she erases even that idea of I from my mind. I see Mother alone exists. So this is that heart behind the heart and that divine presence within, which we intuitively know, but somehow it remains beyond our grasp. It remains beyond the grasp of the mind. It has to be something directly experienced that way. So the question that always arises is, if God dwells within the heart, if God is our very own self, then why don't we know it? Why are we unaware of it? Why don't we have that experience? And for many people will say, I don't even believe it. It seems like a foreign idea to me. Why do we completely identify with everything else, with everything superficial about us? Why do we create an ego which is perfectly unsuited for being happy in this world. Why do we create for ourselves, if our real nature is divine, why do we create for ourselves an ego which is always seeking things outside its grasp, which is never quite content and never quite happy, and feels a little bit like a stranger in this world, and is full of anxiety and fear and all sorts of things? Why do we do that? Now, the answer that we get, of course, is not very conclusive. We have all different ways of looking at it. Somehow it falls within a very large category, which we call Maya. And sometimes what we do, when we don't know the answer to something, we give it a name and think that we've given an answer to it. So if we say, well, why does this happen? We say, oh, it's because of Maya. We say, oh, okay, now I understand. But what is this Maya? Maya is the explanation we give when we don't have an explanation. Really, what's the definition of Maya? That which is inscrutable, that which allows the impossible to happen, that which allows the one to appear as the many, that which allows the impersonal to appear as the personal, that which defies any explanation, which is illogical. This is our definition of Maya, and we think it's an explanation. It's not an explanation, but at least it should stop us from looking for a logical explanation. This is the good part about it. Is it a power? Is it illusion? Is it ignorance? So half of the arguments among the different philosophical schools will center around what the nature of this Maya actually is. But one thing we see, that this inscrutable power, which we call Maya, which makes the impossible possible, somehow has to affect this Brahman. And this is a very tricky point. How does it do that? Does it infect it? Does it simply veil it? Does it make it appear as something that it's not? Is it some type of cosmic ignorance? And this cosmic ignorance, which once this universe comes into existence, seeps into us as individual ignorance. That same Maya that seems to cover Brahman becomes avidya, ignorance, and seems to cover all of us, even though we're all that same Brahman. So what is the nature of this? Now, the most radical point of view is to say that there's no explanation of how the one becomes the many, because the one doesn't become the many. And there's no way of explaining how Brahman undergoes change, because Brahman doesn't undergo change. It's not allowed to. We've given it certain rules. That which is not composed of parts, that which has no beginning and end, that which is beyond time and space and causation, how can it change? That which is infinite, how can it change? How can it have parts? So the strict Advaitins, sometimes they're called Mayavadins, they will have to say that everything is simply an appearance. And through Maya, Brahman has somehow forgotten itself. Somehow it dreams this drama of life and enters into it and gets so involved in playing the role of each and every one of us that completely forgets, like a very good actor who gets so involved in playing the role that he forgets he's an actor and identifies completely with the role that he's playing. Now, as I said, part of the rationale for this theory is that Brahman is pure existence, pure knowledge, that it's absolute in nature, it's not made up of parts or anything, then it can undergo any change. It has to be simply an apparent type of change. And the second issue that they always have to deal with is, if Brahman is pure knowledge, pure awareness, pure knowledge, then how can it come under the sway of ignorance? No matter how powerful this Maya is, how can it affect this infinite absolute Brahman that way, which is pure intelligence, pure knowledge? This is the chit aspect of Satchit Ananda. Now again, a little sleight of hand. There are no very good answers for these things, but we get images again. One very nice image we see in the Vivek Chudamani is that, like the wind that's blowing over the ocean, Now it's just hovering over it. It doesn't really belong to the ocean, but there won't be wind without the ocean and with the turning of the earth. Somehow that causes the wind to blow, and the wind causes the waves to arise. And each wave that comes up is another universe that way. So we have these different types of images like that. We have the image of the snake that contains the venom within it, but protected in a sack inside so that it's unaffected by it, and yet it can bite someone and kill them. That the poison that's in that venom has that power, but the snake is unaffected. So the Brahman is unaffected, and yet has the power to, through some type of cosmic illusion, to give the appearance of this world and enter into it and all of that. So these are the types of answers that we get when we stick to this very strict rule, we can say, that the Maya cannot really belong to Brahman. It can't be a part of it. And also it can't be separate from it. Then we have two realities. We're not allowed that either. So we're only allowed to have Brahman. So the Maya, it belongs to Brahman in a way, but it doesn't affect it, really. It doesn't affect it, the true nature of Brahman. Now, the devotee has a much easier path. The devotee is much bolder. Devotee can freely admit that this Maya represents the divine power. And the divine power, so what's the problem? So why shouldn't God have some power? Right? This Brahman that we're being so strict about has to be inactive in everything. Let's say no. The Nirguna Brahman is also Saguna Brahman. It's one and the same. Of course, the Upanishads ultimately will admit that, but that this Brahman has this power, and this is a divine play that's going on. This is a lila. It's simply sport. There's no good explanation for it, except that the Lord likes to play. We have no good explanation. Mother, the Divine Mother, she wants the play to go on. She enjoys the play. This is all. Again, not logical, but there's a little sweetness to it. It takes the edge off of our suffering a little bit. There's a nice way of looking at it. So here Maya becomes identified with Shakti or power, and an essential aspect of the divine. So Brahman is no longer simply this infinite, absolute, impersonal reality or consciousness, but personal God also. And behind the universe, behind all living beings, behind everything, remains that Brahman, that unchangeable ground of everything. But even the personal God is resting on this Brahman. It is one of the manifestations, we can say, of that. It's inseparable from Brahman as the whiteness is from milk or heat from fire. These are very standard examples we get from Sri Ramakrishna, from the tradition of the worship of Divine Mother. And this is precisely what we get in this line. The stirring of the dust is caused by the horseman. It is he who causes this dust to dance. We don't attribute the dust to anything else other than the horseman. So no second factor here. Only Brahman itself, as Ishvara, as the Lord, as Bhagavan, has to be the source of that. No reference to illusion, to ignorance, anything like that. A simple statement of fact, that very being that dwells within the heart as the sole reality, as our real self, has to be the same one that is causing the dust to dance. Either through his own sweet will, or simply swabhava. That if it's dusty and the horse is moving around, the dust will have to arise. This is simply the nature of things. This is just the way the world is. There's no better explanation than that. Now, I want to make a little digression and talk about a trip that I made to Afghanistan, because I got some insight into all this horse business there. I went in 1971 and was on my way to India. And, of course, no newspapers, no way to know what's going on in the world, nothing. So when I got to Pakistan to go into India, I found out, lo and behold, there's a war going on. So I went back, and I ended up spending about 4 months total in Afghanistan, and it's a land of horses and tremendous horses. I remember going through the first place I went to, a very small town called Herat. And this Herat, there wasn't a single paved road, just one main road that went through, not a single car. There was a bus that would go, you know, long range through the country because there were no trains or anything like that. Everything was horse-drawn buggies. Tangas, they call them, something like that. And dusty. Dust all over the place. Yeah, very dry, dusty place. And in the summer, very hot. In the winter, very cold. I was there throughout the winter, two winters in a row. It was a freezing cold place and everything. But my second time when I went back, waiting for the Indian border to open, I went to a place called Kunduz. Now it's famous because of all the Taliban and everything. And really this country of Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan, were wonderful. It breaks my heart when I see what's going on there and in that whole part of the world, because they were so simple and open and sweet and such a spirit of hospitality and everything. I really had a wonderful time there. Anyhow, this Kunduz is famous for something called Bushkashi. This is the national game of Afghanistan and Central Asia, and it takes place on horseback. And there's a goat skin filled with stone, so it's quite heavy. And really, you just have two teams all on horseback, and they have to grab hold of it, and they have to drag it into a goal on one side or the goal on the other, a big circle like that. And you've never seen such skilled horsemen and such powerful horses in your life, huge, powerful horses. And the horsemen, half the time, they're not even holding on. They're grabbing hold of the goat. And sometimes you'll see two of them both holding one side, and the horses just on their own, they're so intelligent, just going off into the distance, two of them almost vertical like that, not holding on, just with their legs. And just you see the skill of the horsemen, and you see the power of these horses. This is the image that we have here. So when we think of that, we have to just imagine, and the dust flying and everything, the strength and fearlessness and courage. That some of these Bushkashi games, they would even use knives and things, and the horses, they would train them to bite each other and everything. It was really a violent game, but it was fantastic. I couldn't get enough of it. It was really something to watch this. So I was thinking how Swamiji would have loved this idea, the tremendous strength, the skill of the horsemen and the strength of the horses, these powerful steeds, how it would fit in so nicely with his idea of the self, the strength within. Not this simple witnessing consciousness, not the little bird at the top of the tree, this powerful steed with this wonderful rider on top. So Swamiji loved this idea, and he always pointed to the Upanishads as also teaching this idea of strength and fearlessness. With some of his most beautiful quotes are about that. He said, "What makes a man stand up and work? Strength. Strength is goodness. Weakness is sin. If there is one word that you find coming out like a bomb from the Upanishads, bursting like a bombshell upon masses of ignorance, it is the word fearlessness. And the only religion that ought to be taught is the religion of fearlessness. Either in this world or in the world of religion, it is true that fear is the sure cause of degradation and sin. It is fear that brings evil. And what causes fear? Ignorance of our own nature." Then he says, "Take off the veil of hypnotism." Get rid of the dust hiding the horsemen. "Take off the veil of hypnotism which you have cast upon the world, and send not out thoughts and words of weakness unto humanity. Know that all sins and all evils can be summed up in that one word, weakness. It is weakness that is the motive power in all evil doing. It is weakness that makes them manifest what they are not in reality. Let them know what they really are. Let them repeat day and night what they are. Let them suck it in with their mother's milk, this idea of strength. I am he, I am he." Swamiji loved this idea. He used to talk about the lion. We have our Vedanta Keshari, the lion of Vedanta. He used to quote one line, "Nirgachiti Jagajalat Pinjaradivakeshuri. These great souls, when they break through this net of Maya, it's like a lion bursting out of its cage. So we have that image of the lion within or the horseman within. Now, how do we learn to see this horseman in the midst of the dust? Or how do we allow the dust to settle or keep the dust from flying all over the place? How do we find that treasure which is buried within the cave, which is covered by Maya, which is really another way of saying ignorance of our very own nature? Now, the Upanishads give us different images with regard to the nature of the hiddenness of the self. The idea that there's just a little bit of dust hiding it. This is one idea. Or there's a little cloud. Even though a small wisp of a cloud, it can keep us from seeing the sun. But on the other hand, we have different types of images that will say it deeply hidden within, just in some potential form, and we'll get some very nice images. On our Wednesday night class, we're reading this Shvetashvatara Upanishad. It has some beautiful imagery here. Well, we see it in, of course, Sri Ramakrishna and other teachers, but it talks about we have to extract the self from within, the self from, really, we can say from the mind, if we like, the same way that we extract fire from wood. Just as fire is hidden in wood, it exists in wood in a potential form. Or butter and milk, or water in a dry riverbed, oil in the sesame seed. We have these different examples, and they all involve a little bit of hard work. They all involve some type of real spiritual practice. Sri Ramakrishna was especially fond of this butter and milk analogy. He said, "You must practice spiritual discipline a little. It will not do simply to say that milk contains butter. You must let the milk set into curd." So this was solitude. He always emphasized that. You must let the milk set into curd and then churn it. Then we do our spiritual practice. Only then can you get butter from it. This is why Swamiji, in one of his most famous utterances, said that each soul is potentially divine. I used to wonder about that. Why did he say potentially divine? It is divine. We know it's divine. But what he meant was, there's the potential for us to realize it, to extract that truth out of it, the way we extract fire from the wood or butter from the milk, so that we can fully know it, so we can make it our very own. So Swamiji really seems to be emphasizing the fact that we have to strive with great earnestness to realize that. And that it's not the divine nature of the self that's potential, but our realization that's potential. In that particular quote of Swamiji's, he goes on, of course, to talk about all of the four yogas as a different means of realization. But in the same Shvetashvatara Upanishad, we get two very interesting teachings, two very specific things. We find these two words, satyena, through truth, and tapasa, through tapas, through austerity, through truth and through the practice of austerity. Now, this truth, we speak about truth so much, and of course, it's true that truth means this oneness of thought, word, and deed, and practicing truthfulness in everyday life. But I take it as something much deeper and much subtler than that, as a type of authentic living. That truth means we have to live in accordance with a higher truth of our real nature. That every time we identify with our lower nature, every time this ego sticks its head up, and every time we live a life of sense gratification and selfishness and everything, we're untrue to our real nature. There's an inauthentic type of life. So we can take truth in the very high sense of leading an authentic life, leading a life consistent with the truth of our real nature. Then the second is tapas. Tapas, tapasya, we can say is spiritual practice, but not simply going through the motions. It's that spiritual practice that has fire in it, that has intensity in it, the type of intensity that can burn off the impurities of the heart, the type of intensity that can destroy our doubts and eliminate our desires, that can really transform us. So the tapas, it has that idea of heat in it, that it can burn off all of our worldliness through the intensity of our spiritual practice. Now, there's one other method that I want to mention to close here, and that is that if the horseman is the one who's raising the dust, why not go directly to the horseman and say, please, stop for a moment. Let me see your real nature. Why not go to the Divine Mother and say, Mother, remove that veil from your face. Let me have that vision of you. We have a very beautiful verse in the Bhagavad Gita that says, this divine Maya of mine, and Sri Krishna is speaking, but we can say Divine Mother, composed of the three gunas, is difficult to transcend. They alone cross over who take refuge in me. So this seeking refuge in the source of that Maya and looking upon that Maya as divine, looking upon the Divine Mother as our very own Divine Mother dwelling within the heart, who has that power, if she likes, to lift that veil so that we can have that vision of truth. So we pray to the Divine Horseman, stop the dance of the horse for a few moments. Let us see you in all your glory, your majesty, your strength, your fearlessness dwelling within our hearts, making us whirl around. We have another nice verse in the Gita, as if we're mounted on a machine, being tossed here and there. Let us realize that divine presence within as this powerful steed, filling us with the spirit of strength and courage and fearlessness. So we also pray to the Divine Mother, Mother, please remove your veil, let us see your face, and make our life blessed. So, thank you. Let us sit for a few minutes in silence.